That's always good, right? And as teachers, that's what we want. That's what we're not answer distributors, right? We want to provoke questions.
No, I just want the right answer. Just give me the right answer. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Everything That Rises, a podcast about the short stories of the one and only Flannery O'Connor. My name is John Meehan. I'm an English teacher, an instructional coach, a speaker, author, presenter, and I'm based out of Arlington, Virginia, even though I was born and raised in New Jersey, which we don't talk about too much on this podcast because this is a very Southern thing, very genteel. And joining me today is someone who I think you're a lady from the South. Is that a fair way to describe you, Victoria?
Absolutely. Victoria Venuti here, colleague of John's in Arlington, Virginia, also a high school teacher. I teach AP English Literature, and I hail originally from Georgia, so the home state of Flannery O'Connor herself.
Victory. There it is. I had to get some authenticity because I have this northern affect when I talk. So I needed somebody who has a little bit of that sweet southern charm. Where in Georgia were you born and raised, Victoria?
I was born and raised in Woodstock, so a suburb north of Atlanta. And
got it.
Really the only southern accent that I have is the y'all that I drop now and again.
Yeah, where did that come from for you, by the way? I'm like, where did it go to? Because typically, like, if you're born and raised in Georgia, you should have a proper Georgia like sound to you.
Right. Well, both my parents are northern transplants. They're originally from Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
Got yep. It.
Which is like,
so I picked up y'all at some point, and I decided that I really liked it.
Okay, that makes sense because I was like, Savannah, Georgia is very Flannery O'Connor, and having been through Savannah a number of times, like, it's just, it's quintessentially the South. Like, you have the Spanish moss hanging from the trees. It just feels different than the way that you and I talk. And I think when you talk about pronunciation and things like that, that does lead us back into our story, which we'll get into in a second. But when you're in Ohio, I think when they set the, like, the call-in centers where you have to, like, just speak without an accent, they try to mimic the accent from Ohio, which is about as non-accent as you can get in the United States.
Huh. How about that?
You'll learn stuff. Things like yep. That. Yay, linguistics. Are you on the Twitter machines? People can find you there if they want to hang out with you afterwards.
Absolutely. My handle is at MissBDJO.
Awesome. And the Miss is for Miss, the B is for Benuti, and the DJO is for Dennis J. O'Connell High School, where we work. Yeah. Awesome. And mine is Meehan, EDU. That's Meehan, like my last name, and EDU, like teaching. We both teach English. We both have been teaching for between us, like 15 years or something. So let's talk about Flannery O'Connor. And we're getting back into our conversation about the short story Revelation. When last we left off, Victoria, do you want to kind of give us a drive-by recap of where we were for people who have not heard last week's? By the way, if you have not heard last week's, go back into the podcast archive. And feel free to dig back into it. We're going to take on the second half of Revelation this week. But do you want to catch us up to speed about folks who might have been out for the first half?
Sure thing. So we left off in the doctor's office where our story opened, introduced to a cast of characters from all sorts of walks of life in the South, including the rather large Mrs. Turpin.
Yes.
Connor makes no bones about letting us know about her size.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
Yep. And but very fair, very nice skin, very nice skin.
And a good disposition.
Exactly.
Bless her heart.
That's the most important thing. and the girl that ends up becoming this sort of antagonist, Mary Grace, this acne-faced college-aged girl who at the end of where we left off had become so bottled up with anger and rage that we can just see in her eyes and in her purple face that she then hurls her human development textbook at
yes.
Mrs. Turpin's face. And it hits its mark.
That was it. It hits its mark. She then dives in with her claws, tries to choke her like she shouldn't be allowed to even talk. And as she's wrapping up, she has one last parting shot where they're pulling her away. She's like half suffocated and whatever it is like that. She turns her eyes and the girl gives her a look. And that's where we left off last time. You know, like the girl has one parting shot before she leaves and tells her she hopes that she, is it go to hell, you old warthog or something like that?
Exactly. Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog, in a low but clear whisper.
Low but clear whisper. All right. Excellent. So that's where we left off with our story here. And that's not good. It's not a nice message to be left as the go back to hell where you came from. But here we have it. And our hero, or our protagonist, is now sent forth with an opportunity to, like, figure out what happens next. Now, I'll be 100% honest with you. When I first read this, because for the podcast, I said, hey, pick a story you love and let's talk about it. I love Flannery O'Connor's stuff. I've read a bunch of it, but I haven't read all of it. And this one was a blind spot for me. So I knew nothing about this story. And when we went off air last time, I asked, so did you expect it to go this way the first time through? And then when we kind of got off air, you said, so what about for me? And I was like, I'll be honest, I thought it was going to end at this part. Because a lot of times with her stories, when I was reading it on the Kindle, I didn't have that tactile sense of how many pages were left in the book. So I didn't know when it would end. I was like, yep, that makes sense. You know, she had it coming. So she gets a, you know, that moment of grace, go to hell, you old warthog. And that could be it in my version of the story. But it's not. And you said when you assigned this to your students, that was where the PDF, I guess, breaks.
Exactly. Yes. And the PDF I used when I taught the story to sophomores for American literature, I would purposely split their packet in half. And it conveniently, this page ends right after Mary Grace delivers her parting shot comment.
Yeah.
So it worked out really well. Bring him back in, ready to...
Let me ask you that story. It is like a cliffhanger, but like if the story were to end there, right there, like, you know, her eyes burn for a moment as if she saw with pleasure that her measure had struck its target, without leaving, I mean, too many runners on the bases, does this give you a meditation or a reflection if that were to be the end of this story here, 21 pages into, I guess what's like more like a 40-page or 35-page story, if that was to be it? Would that be it? How would the message change?
I think it could end there, but then it would really be really leave the reader just grappling with, but how does Mrs. Turpin react to it? Does it make sense for Mary Grace to have the last word, or should it be Mrs. Turpin that gets the last word? If Mrs. Turpin isn't, by the author's reckoning, able to say anything in response or in some sort of defense, that right. could be an interesting authorial decision. I certainly think that if it left off here, this would be an excellent place to invite students or readers to write what happens next, to write what yeah. happens. How does Mrs. Turpin respond? Does she respond?
And what do you do in that moment, right? Like that's a really good question. See, I think about it because in preparing for this podcast, I've been like cramming a lot of Flannery O'Connor stuff and like reading. And I don't know that I have an answer to it, but I do know that there's patterns to her stories. And like you develop, like when you read Shakespeare, there's like a cadence to things, like the rise, the fall, the ups, the downs, or whatever that looks like. I was reading Good Country People. And in it, we have a Bible salesman whose name is Manly Pointer, which is a really awkward and really unfortunate name. And he encounters a very poor family. I think the Hopewells is the name of the family. And there's a girl who has a wooden leg who he takes up to the barn and the hayloft. And he plans on like seducing her, or that's what she plans on doing to him. But he is a straight nihilist. And he's like, I don't even care. And he just gets her to take her leg off. And he says, you ain't so smart. I've been believing in nothing ever since I was born. And then he just runs away with her leg. And that's the end of the story. Like 16 pages in, like there's no redemption. There's no reflection. And so having read a lot of O'Connor to get to this point in this story called Revelation, I was like, I think you're right. Like, is it fair in a story called Revelation that the last word would belong to anyone but our hero or our protagonist? But the cadence is also like, what can we learn from her being on the receiving end of that attack? Like, I know we shouldn't justify violence against people, but did she have it coming? Like in this first half of the story where she was, you know, being a good Southern woman and then she, you know, made it worse for herself by mentioning Jesus and all that. I don't know. I'm interested to hear your kind of read on the first half of the story as we get into the second half.
I'm trying to think back to also how my students had reacted. Because when I gave this to them, this first half, I didn't tell them it was a first half.
Either. Oh, okay.
So that's I let evil. Them think that the story ended.
Okay.
And just thinking back, there were some students that were like, whoa, that's an ending. I mean,
that's dark, bro. Yeah.
You're just left there and you're just sitting with that. And I think that's also, even if you're going to then continue in the story, it's an interesting place to pause and just sit with that, because I think that's what, going into the second half, that's what Mrs. Turpin does. It sits with her, and that is this weight.
That's a good question. So I think there's a John Dewey quote that says, we do not learn through experience, we learn by reflecting on experience. And I think that's it. Like, the experience takes us to the midpoint of our story, which is maybe mathematically just a little north of the midpoints, maybe 57% of the way through it if you're reading it online. But here we have a woman who's clearly had a trauma. And what she does with that will ultimately define who she is as a person. In the first half of the story, we were talking about how, like, when she goes to bed, instead of counting sheep, she counts her blessings at the expense of those around her who she believes are less fortunate. So she's not just saying, thank God for the flowers and the trees and for my, you know, this, that, and the other. She's basically saying, thank God I'm X and not Y. And then she proceeds to list all the people who are X's and Y's and Z's in sort of a caravan. It seems like she's, you know, needs a shaking up. Is that a fair assessment in this first half of the story?
Hands down. Yep. Yep. Hands down. I think that O'Connor is definitely setting this woman up for a shakeup. Yes.
Yeah. And I think that, in there's that Flannery O'Connor quote, too, that says it's in radical encounters with blasphemy that we encounter faith. Like, it's when you are forced to be staring down the barrel of a gun, that line from Good Man is Hard to Find, she would have been a good woman every day of her life if there was someone there to shoot her. You know, like, if there is someone there to shoot you every minute of every day, then you live like it's your last minute. So how would you live your life? Mm-hmm. And in this moment, it seems like Miss Turpin has a chance to kind of get better. So let's process this. Let's kind of walk that through, because she's in a doctor's office and she has been attacked. What are your initial reactions about the way that she, when you take that second day with your students, right? Like, how does it start? And is it like a hard reset, or is it like a immediate reaction, or does it come in waves? I mean, I don't know. I'm really interested to hear how that kind of has played out with your own teaching of the story.
Sure. So after we would, like, they, you know, come in, we're talking about the story, the reactions. I think just with how, I'm trying to remember, because it's always, every time you teach something, it's always a little bit different. So I think one year we had, we read this, I paced it so that they read about half, or we started the story in class. Then they read the next half of it or so, or a little bit more for homework. And then we came into class and we continued reading up to that point. So, like, we read the book tossing, or not tossing. That's way too soft. The book hurling.
Hurling.
The book hurling.
Projectile.
The girl hurling herself then at Mrs. Turpin.
Yes.
Reading that out in class, because it is, sure, it is so dramatic, and, you know, you want that impact. And so then we'd get to that end, and then I'd let them think that it's the end, and we'd talk about what they thought was the end. And then I say, all right, so for tonight's homework, we're continuing the story. And they're like, what? This doesn't end there? It's like, no, faked you out. That would actually be an awesome thing to do on April Fool's Day.
Today,
you know? Huh.
There it is. Yeah, right. Plot twist, half of story. There we go. That's really interesting. But I'm looking at this too, like, with this midpoint, this big twist. So this girl attacks, this violent Mary Grace girl attacks, but then her eyes are a lighter blue than they've ever been before. Like, there's a moment of peace, as if, like, a door has been opened or closed, that now that rage or that boil is over. And then they describe her in a very docile way. They say the girl's fingers were gripped like a baby's around her mom's thumb. Like, she's suddenly much quieter and much more subdued.
Well, and they do sedate her.
They did stab her with a thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I think that's really important too, because you mentioned about that line about, like, tossed is not violent enough. It went through a very violent thing. And when I went one time, I did a Spartan race and a Tough Mudder, like all that stuff that those obstacle courses were outside, where you just put yourself in stupid, dramatic, traumatic situations. I think that the Tough Mudder actually raises money for the Wounded Warrior Project. And what they said in the hype man before we started, he says, you know, I want to talk about those who are in the group, or those who are here who are veterans, and people all clap for them. And he says, and I want to talk about anybody who's dealing with PTS. And I was like, I think he means PTSD, but this is not the time to correct people while you're on a obstacle course race, right? Like, just shut up and do the race. But he said, no, I call it PTS because if you come back from combat and trauma and you don't have some sort of stress, that would be a disorder. Like, it's disordered to pretend like you're fine. Sure, and that everything's back to normal. So like, yeah, this gal gets like, you know, jabbed with a needle and she's forced to calm down. But as the situation calms down here, there's like, it's a hard reset. And I don't know what to make of this and maybe what make of our characters. Cause we really are kind of, okay, that's act one. Now let's reset the table for act two. And I feel like Miss Turpin for us has a chance to like, just kind of be, you know, it's how you react to how you got hit that just determines your character. And so like the first moments back, you immediately feel sympathy for this person, or at least the author, I'm sure, wants you to. And the first thing she says is, you know, leave me be, see about Claude. She kicked him. You're like, oh, she's nice. She makes sure her husband's okay. But then like 3 seconds later, when the doctor is trying to like, hey, are you all right? You know, go home, get some rest, have a vacation. Quit your petting me, Mrs. Turpin growled there. Yep. Like same old, same old. I don't know. Interested to hear your thoughts about this about face or this lack thereof.
I think it's there's this since like thinking about the or trying to envision right as a reader what this looks like with this girl who's who's had her right her fingers like claws around Mrs. Turpin's neck and then says delivers her line in such a way that it's low and it's a whisper and it's a direct hit and. Then Mrs. Turpin is like left with that and sinks back in her chair and it's like this is going to send shockwaves and as she's dealing with this she just kind of wants to be left alone,
yeah,
to think over it, and I guess I see the her directing of the attendant's attention to her husband more so as an act of deflection, right? Go away from me and take care of somebody else rather than, oh, I care about my husband in this moment.
That's a good point. And it doesn't even say she kind of like growls it away. She doesn't even say it like thickly shook him off. So she's not being kind there. She's just trying to like, just don't want to think about it.
Shoving everything else out of the way.
You know, man, I have a lot of thoughts. I have a lot of questions, I guess. Like, because the white trash lady, no offense, it's Flannery O'Connor's language here. She's trying to like make the situation better. Of course, she didn't do anything to help in this situation. She just let it unfold. Then she turns around like, you know, white trash lady, catch me outside, how about that? And she's like, that girl there ain't gonna be a lunatic, ain't she? Yeah, she gonna be a lunatic. And that's it. Like, she's just immediately in judgment of that scene that just played out. This girl who attacked, oh, she'd go to the asylum. Yeah, she lunatic. Derp, derp, derp. And that's it. And, like, nobody challenges that. No one checks that. I feel like in this moment, Miss Turpin, maybe, like, it's brand new for her, so she isn't expected to be a better person immediately. But like you read a book with a character who's gone through some sort of like harrowing ordeal, like Huckleberry Finn, and you're like, wow, I hope he learned something through that whole mess because, you know, it's a really hard lot in life and he doesn't have to keep living that way. But right. In the end, I'm like, does he become less racist by the end of that book? Because I think in the end of that book, he's right back to doing dumb stuff with Tom Sawyer. Like he doesn't immediately snap into, oh, there's a moral to the story here. And I think in some ways that's very true, and I talk about a Catholic thing, like it's in that moment of grace we want to be better, but like that's why we have confession and penance, and like we have to keep doing it because that reconciliation is not a one-time thing that you just claim to be saved by Jesus and you're better. Like, no, that's clearly not the case, and Miss Turpin here is still a work in progress even after this pretty real trauma.
Absolutely. And I think it's for as far as the like arc or the trajectory of the story, the insult that Mary Grace delivers is to go back to hell where you came from. We have this Mrs. Turpin before this who is praising Jesus and thinks highly of herself and that she's a good Christian woman. And so if she's wanting to hear some sort of revelation,
there we go.
I don't think that go to hell is what she was expecting at all.
Ooh, shots fired.
Like, that's sort of harsh for those judgment. Burns. then with the women that are talking in the waiting room, trying to, you know, smooth things over, as you pointed out, I think it's interesting that the white trash woman goes into this, I thank God I ain't a lunatic. And we think immediately of Mrs. Turpin. She was just earlier saying and thinking these things like, I thank God that I am not this and not that. But she doesn't say anything. She doesn't join in this conversation. So we can see that she's drawn. She's withdrawn at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point.
She's thinking.
And I think that, so that next paragraph is good too. Just on the PDF version on page 22, that thing that says, you know, they came limping out and then they go back home. As the pickup truck turned their own dirt road and made the crest of the hill, Mrs. Turpin gripped the window ledge and looked out suspiciously. So like now she's on high alert, like that thousand yard stare, because she's already been attacked once today. And so she's feeling triggered or about to blow up. But then it talks about like this very bucolic, very nice description of the land. It says the land sloped gracefully down through a field dotted with lavender weeds. At the start of the rise, a yellow small frame house with its little flower bed spread out around it like a fancy apron, sat primly in its accustomed place between two giant hickory trees. But then it vacillates right back to, she would not have been startled to see a burnt wound between two blackened chimneys. Like, something has flipped inside of her now in a very violent way, right?
Yeah. I just have to say, I'm so glad you pointed this out. I have never really, like, read this paragraph. I guess in my reading of it, I've always glanced over it. But I'm like, oh my gosh, she's looking at her, you know, her house that's all, like, just like her on the outside, all as it should be. And she's looking at it and thinking, I wouldn't be surprised if that was burnt to shreds. Like, wait, what?
So you're like, you're lulled into, no, there's some beautiful things. There's some very heavy things. You're very dangerous things. And that seems to be like foreshadowing that there's something that in her headspace is not good while she returns to her home, which should be like her castle. But she ain't feeling it. You know, and then she has this nightmare image of a razorback hog with warts on his face, horns coming out of his ears, snorting in her head. Like, life isn't good for her now. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Flannery O'Connor wants us to feel bad for her? And that's a hard question to ask, because I think she wants to feel bad for everyone at all times, but not to pity them, but rather to empathize and to be aware. But do you think this moment?
I was about to say, I think at some point during the story, and whether it's the point in which she's called a warthog from hell, or at this point when she is clearly like thinking over this and saying in her head, right, I'm not a warthog from hell, right? This denial. I think at some point around this point is when we're supposed to start identifying with Mrs. Turpin somehow, that we've had some sort of similar, not please God, so help, intense an experience, right?
Yeah.
But there are these experiences that jar us out of ourselves, and that we deny that it could be any sort of revelation, that there could be any sort of grace that's operating here.
There's a moment in here of self-denial, which is in some ways worse than a denial of the, like, what you'd say to anybody else. You know, it says the denial had no force. She kind of thinks about this thing. You know, the full force of fact struck her now. There was a woman in there who was neglecting her own child. She'd been overlooked. But this message was given to me. I was a respectable, hard-working, church-going woman. And then the eyes began to burn instead with wrath. Like, you talk about your Kubler-Ross model, right? In this moment, this woman is going through denial, then bargaining, then, like, anger. Before you get to acceptance, there's like a lot of stages you have to get through. And it looks right now that she's pissed. And because she's pissed, she kind of wants to take the world down with her. And it seems like she's spoiling for a fight. I'm bothered, and I want to talk about this too. She makes her husband give her a kiss, but doesn't want to tell him what's going on with her, because she doesn't want to pay it forward. She loves him too much. And he has a baby blue eye and he's sleeping. So she's no, never mind. Go back to sleep. And then afterwards, he has to go work with, I guess, the hired hands who are black out in the field. And she's like, okay. And then she's like, you know what? I want to tell somebody about what happened. But it's like too shocking to say to my husband. It would bring him down. And I don't want to destroy him with that. So she like decides to follow along. And as it says here, here's the pickup truck coming back with the Negroes. So she'll go and spend time with them and talk to them by bemoaning her lot in life. Because it's like okay to dump garbage on people who are less than, but she wouldn't do that to her own kin or her own family. I don't know. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts about that. Like that, that bothers me a lot.
So I guess I've taken it a different way that again, it's not so much concern for Claude, but that she sees, since Claude's somebody that she's used to pushing around, that Claude can't really meet her on her level and receive what she's saying, that it'll like somehow go over his head or he just won't get it.
Yeah,
so she's like, too. It's not even worth talking to him about it. And she kind of like, it's, and it says, top of our page 25, that Claude's there snoring, and says she wanted to tell him what the girl had said. At the same time, she did not wish to put the image of herself as a warthog from hell into his mind. So rather than care and concern for him, it's concern for herself. She doesn't want her own image to be brought down in her husband's mind. And that also, like, what's he going to think?
Right.
And then just next, she then, like, when she wakes him up, it says he opens one pale baby blue eye. And again, we have blue eyes, right? You had pointed out Mary Grace's eyes were blue.
Yes.
And that she's looking into it warily. He did not think about anything. So is he even going to be able to receive what she says if she says something? But also, like I said last time, John, one thing that I'm drawn to in this reading is the eyes. I'm looking for anything about eyes. And it's been so cool because we've seen blue eyes. And then now Mrs. Turpin's eyes began to burn instead with wrath after this denial.
And so that idea of being seen, that even if you don't realize that someone's always watching you, there's... In A Good Man Is Hard to Find, they talk about that, like the family's car tumbles off a hill and it flips over once, and they're on the bottom of the hill screaming, we had an accident. And the misfit and his gang of bad guys roll up in the top, and they said, is everything all right down here? They said, yeah, we had an accident. Our car flipped over twice. And the misfit says, once we saw it. Like the misfit in that moment is sort of playing God. Like, you might not know who is watching you, but someone is always watching you, lady. And that's a dangerous thing, because those lies that we tell ourselves, like, someone sees even if you don't see. If God is real, and in the world of Flannery O'Connor, God is very real. Like, talking about
even
opening
if he's
haunting. Eyes. And, right. Opening eyes and closed eyes. Like, you can close your eyes all you want to, but, like, what's that? I think it's The Violent Bear It Away. Or Wise Blood. And in Wise Blood, the main character's name is Hazel Motes. Like, talk about the mote in your eye, versus the speck in your eye versus, or the plank in your eye versus the speck in someone else's eye.
Oh, that is, like, so good.
Oh, yeah. And, like, that's a big Flannery O'Connor trick, is that she does this stuff where, like, eyes and sight and vision, and, like, as people reach for their glasses or get attacked over their eye, like, her eye is swelling shut. But as she loses physical sight in some ways, she gains a second sense of spiritual sight, and that revelation really is a seeing again, like something that was previously hidden from you now becomes open. They talk about opening and closing of eyes. But I think you're right, and I'm humbled by what you're pointing out here, because she's not trying to keep it from her husband because she respects him. It's because she respects herself too much and doesn't want to be seen as anything less than in the eyes of other people. That's not a praise of him. It's still a very high image of herself, right?
She's still got a way to go in processing all of this.
Yeah. And she's scowling away. That's a good point. So she does. She goes and walks away, and then he goes and takes care of whatever it is. And as the protuberance of her eye has turned a greenish blue, you know, she goes and he takes care of, I guess, the farmhands. She then does, and it bothers me, and we talked about, like, some race issues. We talked about race last time in the podcast, too, but, like, she did not get up until she heard that pickup coming back with the Negroes. Then she rose and thrust her feet into her brown Oxfords, which she did not bother to lace, then stepped on the back porch, got her red plastic bucket. She emptied a tray of ice cubes into it and filled it half full of water, went out to the backyard. It almost feels like here she's tending to, like, livestock and animals as she's tending to the arrival of black folk in her house. Like, she doesn't welcome them as equals, as people who are, you know, even people. She looked at the white trash in the place. Hey, that daughter should have attacked the white trash, not me. And now I'm going to go take care of. It's a resentment. She doesn't even bother her tying her shoes. She grabs a cheap plastic bucket. There's no kindness or empathy or I guess accompaniment when she goes to be with people who are in her mind less than.
Right. Exactly. And this isn't bringing out your tray of lemonade to the porch and having a sit down.
Right.
This is bringing a bucket of water.
Yeah. It's Martha and Mary, right? Like, it's giving your slaying the fatted calf, being the best version of yourself for the company. And instead she's like, hi y'all this evening, Mrs. Turpin asked grimly. Like, that's not a conversation. It's a thing I was forced to say because that's what I'm expected to do. But it's not, it's nothing welcoming. It's nothing between friends.
Right. And then as we continue in their conversation, we start to get a sense of, and again, just like the beginning when we're in the doctor's room, now with this conversation going on, we're paying attention to what Mrs. Turpin is saying out loud and what she's saying inside her head.
Yes, 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 yes. So like she's trying to, you know, make conversation because I think in some ways she's fishing for pity, fishing for people to be nice to her. Like they notice she has this giant lump on her head and like, you good? And she's like, oh no, I'm fine. I didn't fall down. It was something worse than that. And then like the poor black folk there, ain't nothing but happened to you. Ain't nothing bad happened to you. You just had a little fall. They're trying to be nice, trying to like say that she was in some ways protected by some divine providence. But she's bothered by the fact that she in her mind is still better than these people. How dare they even think to pity me? So like one by one by one, she spells out her story with increasing detail where she's always the good guy in her version of the story. And wham, she throws this big book she was reading at me. And then they're all like, oh no, it couldn't have been.
It's this storytelling. You know, she's, right. I mean, when we look over how she's telling the story, well, she's really not exaggerating.
No.
it really was that violent.
Yeah, but you're right.
Their reactions, their exclamations, I mean, the way that she's breaking it up into pieces, she's playing it up.
Yeah, she's playing for the pity.
Get that pity. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. She's in some ways proud. I don't know. Like there's a lack of humility in the telling of this story because it's like, mm-hmm. I'm still the victim here, I guess.
And it only gets more dramatic. And she continues she's building to the good point, right? That one line, the warthog from hell line, and she's building to it. And when it gets to that point where she's going to deliver it, she stops and ends up looking up at the sun, yes. And it describes her face as dark and the sun is white, and she's not able to say it.
But I have a question there too. And I think she can say it. I think that that's for emphasis. And what O'Connor's doing is juxtaposing this woman's, this is not a racial comment, but like the blackness of her character, like the darkness of her visage against this white shining sun in the sky. And then you can kind of have a play on words with the sun, like the son of God. Like if God sees all things and is peeking through in this brilliant, bright white, like white is good, black is bad, not about race, but about just color imagery here. Like she is in darkness. She is in shadow. She has dark, nasty things she wants to reveal. Meanwhile, the sun is giving the thing to say, look, just let it go, man. Let the wind blow. Let the sun shine. Like it's going to be okay. The same thing you didn't want to say in front of your husband because you didn't want to make yourself look bad there. Don't make these folks have to carry that around, that image. She has a chance to not say it. And she pauses and says, well, it was something real ugly. And then they wait, they go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It's the truth before Jesus, the old woman said. And then she's bothered by the fact that the black folks mentioned Jesus. You're the sweetest and prettiest woman I know, says Miss Turpin, knew just exactly how much Negro flattery was worth. And it added to her rage. So almost as if like to screw them, she's like, no, you know what? I'm going to say the damn thing. Like, mm-hmm. That's ugly. It's an ugly, ugly human thing to do there. I don't know, but I'm wondering if that's maybe just me thinking back, like, do you do that? Do I do that? Do we all do that? Where like, hey, I've been made to suffer, so I'm going to make the world burn down around me a little bit. Like, you want it to be a little colder and a little bit grayer because you're having a bad day.
And just thinking of, you know, stories or things that happen to us, the ways that we communicate them, the ways that we tell people about them. Of course, we can, you know, add some stretchers, as Huckman would say, or we can tell it like it is. So our responsibility in many ways to telling the truth when we're retelling stories, whether those are our own stories or perhaps even more so the stories of others. But as she's telling the story, which is hers, I just find it fascinating that she's provoked into saying this. That she's right, bringing up the old warthog from
or now. She lies to herself and says that says that she's provoked, right? Like, you know, like who she said that's you? Let me see. I'll kill her with you. The other one says she belonged in the asylum. Again, we talk about crazy. You're the sweetest white lady I know. Pretty too. I believe Jesus is so satisfied with you. Indeed, he is. And then she responds in her head, "Idiots," growled to herself. You could never say anything intelligent to N words, right? You could talk at them, but never talk with them. And so she changes the subject very quickly. So she tells herself that, like, I was provoked into saying this, but, like, no, she's sitting in judgment of people, not treating them as equals, fishing for their compliments. When they give the compliments that you were fishing for, you're like, oh, they're just like, you can't win. You can't win right. with this person.
Like, and it's like, she's clearly wanting to tell somebody about this and have it be, I don't know. It's like, she wants to have a conversation about it. And she goes to, or she first, you know, looks at Claude, but that's not going to work because then her image in his eyes is going to be brought down. So then she tries the ladies, and at first it's working out with the flattery, and, you know, maybe, as we said, she's fishing for compliments there. But eventually it becomes too much. It's almost sickening to her.
Yeah.
She's like, no, you can't even have a conversation. It's just talking. It's like nobody's hearing her.
Yeah. No. And I think that's it too, is she doesn't get the answers from the people around her. And I think the story here, uses the word about the comforters of Job, reasonable seeming, but wrong. You know, like in the story of the Bible, Job has everything taken from him, and he's understandably, like, you know, perplexed about his new lot in life. And his three friends come and they just hang out with him. And, like, I think if I read it correctly in the Catholic understanding, like, they just sit with him for, like, a few days. And, like, that is so important, to have empathy, that someone else is just sitting with you in your grief or in your sadness. But then, because they're trying to make it better, they start asking questions like, well, do you think God did this to you because you did X or did Y or did Z? And, like, they're trying to pepper him with questions about all these reasons why he's right and God's wrong. Like, he's somehow been made a victim here. And that's where the well-meaning, the well-intentioned things kind of go off the rails. And I feel like in this moment, Miss Turpin is kind of like a Job-like character, because nobody gives her the answer she wants. She's angry. She wants to sit in her anger, sit in her grief. And then she sort of takes it out on God. I mean, she goes and sort of shouts at the sky a little bit. It's a very Job-like scene, I think, that unfolds.
And then continuing with the story, you know, she's wanting to, as we've said, just express this to someone. So she tries her husband, tries the ladies, and now...
Two strikes.
Now she heads off to the pig parlor.
Right.
And it says that she's squaring her shoulders and had the look of a woman going single-handed, weaponless, into battle.
Yeah. Like,
so she's going to confront down, this.
Man. Heck yeah.
And so why is she going to the pig parlor? I mean, is it because of the warthog comment? She's going to go look at, you know, the closest thing to a warthog.
Right.
Hmm.
I'm interested in that, because in this moment, she's pissed, she's angry, she's talked to her husband, who she views as lesser than her, and won't say the thing to him. She talks to the black folk, who she believes are even lesser than him, and she'll say it, but not be happy with what they had to say. So then she finds herself in the pen with the hogs, and, like, all right, I'm going to shout this while she's spraying him in the face with, like, the hose, trying to wash down the whole thing. And, like, she's literally covered in all sorts of muck and mire. Like, you can't get much lower. And here we have this scene where this is the Christian, like, Catholic upbringing for me, but, like, I'm reminded of the prodigal son who, like, comes back and says, like, hey, Dad, I screwed up. I'm not even worthy of, like, lying down in your house. So put me up with the hogs. Like, I don't even deserve a place in your space. And then Dad's like, nah, we're going to go ahead and kill the fatted calf. We're going to put the ring on your finger. We're going to welcome you back, because I still love you. And this whole thing is, like, about you moving away from and recognizing how you need to be humbled, and you have to come back to grace, and how to recognize you can't do it by yourself. I don't know. There's a beautiful, like, juxtaposition of this scene here, because this woman is not coming with any humility while she's playing with the hogs. She's doing the exact opposite, like spraying them down as if they're less than, and then she's somehow better than, and just shouting. And I don't know. There's an ugliness to the scene.
Well, and there's this contrast in, like, yes, an ugliness, but what's she doing? She's hosing them down. So it's like they're being cleaned.
Yeah.
Right.
Like a baptism.
And then, yeah. And then there's also this, what she's thinking in her head, that it says she'd read that pigs were the most intelligent animal. She doubted it. They were supposed to be smarter than dogs. There'd even been a pig astronaut. And she goes about the pig astronaut.
Yes.
And then,
by the way, I Googled to see if that was true. Like, nice. And I'm getting mixed reactions of pig astronaut, but, like, that her brain is just going down that rabbit hole of, oh, so smart, huh? You're so smart. You figure it out. Like, I don't know. That's, there's something about that that's very beautiful and also very, very sad. I don't know.
Right. And this always, I bring up this, this one quote from Flannery O'Connor that she wrote in a letter to one of her friends. So I think you'd brought up last time that Flannery O'Connor herself was no stranger to suffering since she suffered from lupus, an autoimmune disorder.
Right.
And the treatment that she endured at one point was manufactured from pig parts. So she has this great quote, which ties in with what we've been discussing too about the pig, something you brought up. So O'Connor writes, "I owe my existence and cheerful countenance to the pituitary glands of thousands of pigs butchered daily in Chicago, Illinois, at the Armour packing plant.
Oh my God.
If pigs wore garments, I wouldn't be worthy to kiss the hems of them."
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. That's so twisted and so cool. And now I have so many questions.
I know. I know.
Yes. All right. Well, there you have it. I mean, things you learned about modern science. I mean, I was thinking about pigs in outer space. Now I want to figure out how they keep the pituitary glands of pigs to keep people with lupus, I guess, conditions at bay.
Exactly. Yep.
All right. Well, there we have it. So, yeah, I mean, I don't have an answer for it, but she is sort of fixated on something that's pig here, you know, like so she's mad and angry.
I guess I, because of course it's worth asking, okay, well, why is it pigs? Why isn't it the goats or the chickens or the cows, right, or the peacock, since we're talking Flannery O'Connor? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
because I think ultimately, like, and I think about Huck Finn too, like when he uses the N word, he says, "You can't learn an N to argue, so I quit." Like in that moment, the N word is just like a disposable, like, well, you know how black people can be. And so he throws it around there casually. But then another line later in the book, he says, "I felt so ashamed of myself. And if I were any more ashamed, well, then I'm an N." Like, it's the worst word he can possibly think to use. And that's why he uses it in that sequence. I think in this moment, O'Connor is taking the dirtiest, the messiest, the foulest thinking, stinking animal that you can have and putting our character right there. Like, you gotta burn your whole self away before you have that moment of revelation, of grace. Like, this is the lowest of the low. There's nothing beautiful or aspirational about this scene.
Nope. And it just it descends from there, because she's at first she walks over to Claude and is looking over these pigs, and then she takes over to hose down the pigs, sends mm-hmm. Claude off, and then I always thought this part's interesting is when she starts talking out loud. Who is she talking to? Is she talking to herself? Is she addressing it to the pigs? Is she addressing God? Does she switch who she's talking to, and how do we know?
Yeah, that line, you know, "What do you send me a message like that for? You know, how am I a hog and me both? How am I saved and from hell too?" And you can see, like, if she was going into battle, well, Claude left, so she's not battling with Claude. And the pigs can't talk back, so she's really not talking to them. Like, she's shouting, you know, like, against the wind in some ways. And it feels like this is a direct shot at God, which is the opposite of Job, right? Job's friends tell him, "Well, just tell God it's his fault because he's picking on you for this thing, and he's, like, doing too much. He's seeking revenge for something." And Job refuses to bite on that. He's like, "No, this isn't something that I'm doing as a revenge or as a penance or something else. It's just, like, this is acceptance of God's will. I can't change this, and I don't ever pretend that I'm going to understand it. All I can do is try to endure it." And that's the opposite of what this woman is doing here. "Why me? There's no trash around here, black and white, I haven't given to. I break my bone every day for work, and I do for the church. I don't know, Victoria, you're a better person than me, but have you had that conversation with Jesus? Because I have."
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Right.
And like, there's things that happen, and you get mad. And the cool thing is, it's okay to be mad. Like, God's okay if you get mad at him.
Yeah, I think it's Kierkegaard who says, like, you have a creator who loves you so much that he gives you the radical free will up to and including your ability to destroy his own creation. Like, that's how much mm-hmm. he loves you. If you believe God exists, and again, O'Connor does, this is the type of thing that would be in her head. Like, wow. You know, if you like trash better, go make yourself some trash. You could have made me trash, or an N-word. If trash is what you want, why didn't you make me trash? She shakes her fist in the air. You know, I could quit working and take it easy, all filthy. And this whole thing is just, what do you think you are? And in a moment, we get a revelation. Oh, like, do you want to walk us through this idea about this, what this warthog from hell lady is finally seeing in the end, because she sees the exact opposite of from the bottom. She gets to see what it looks like at the top.
Exactly. And so she's been yelling and trying to figure out the answer. And it's really easy to miss. I know I missed it the first time, or maybe, you know, first, second time reading through. But as you're reading this, you know, taking into account the colors that are changing, the sunset, you know, how this is happening. And then she's yelling, go on, call me a hog again, from hell, call me. So she's going from questioning God to now commanding God, daring God, or whoever she's talking to. Right. Put that bottom rail on top. There'll still be a top and a bottom. Then it says a garbled echo returned to her. And then a final surge of fury shook her and she roared. Who do you think you are? The color of everything, field and crimson sky, burned for a moment with a transparent intensity. The question carried over the pasture and across the highway and the cotton field and returned to her clearly like an answer from beyond the wood. So what comes back to her? Who do you think you are? The echo is yelled back at her.
Oh, man. And like, that's it too. Like, so high and mighty, huh? You know, you couldn't get the question answered by your husband. Couldn't get it answered by your servants or your slaves or the hired hands. Can't get it answered by animals. Like, it's a moment of reflection. It's a moment of revelation. Who do you think you are? And that's hard because it's the ultimate Socratic irony, which is the best teacher. It's like, I never said anything. I just asked you a question. I don't know. Who do you think you are? And in that moment, she opens her mouth, but then no sounds come of it. And everything seems so small. She says her husband's truck looked like a child's toy. It could look like any moment a bigger truck comes smash it all away. Like in a brief moment, her eyes become like the eyes of how God might see her. Like you're very, very small. Like the little things that you're whining about, you're a speck on a speck that like orbits around another speck in a universe full of infinite numbers of specks and particles. Who are you again? I'm sorry. Right? Like,
right.
New universe. Who dis? Like, there's something about this the perspective thing where she just stares at the highway and it opens her up to like almost a transcendental understanding of her relationship to how big the world, the universe is.
Absolutely. And I mean, throughout the story, we have this different imagery of vision and eyes and seeing and perspective and different colors and whatnot. So here, when, as you pointed out, her vision is, it's like looking at something so distinct and far away, and yet her eyes are being opened.
Right? Yeah.
Also, as I would discuss in with my classes, they all think that this moment is so profound, right? This echo, and there's a beauty to it. And then O'Connor comes in and they're like, she ruins it. I'm like, what do you mean she ruins it? It's like the next part, it looked like a child's toy. At any moment, bigger truck might come and smash into it and scatter the brains all over the road. And they're like, she ruined it. Why do you have to talk about brains in that moment? Like, just leave us with the beautiful image. And it's a fair question for O'Connor.
It is, but I also think it's like, but that's how God works. If God is real, let's just follow this logic. Like, God is big, I am small. God can take you in any moment of beauty and humble you. Like, you're all only ever one phone call away from radical unraveling of everything that you think and know. And that, you know, these acts of violence that come up out of nowhere are like, if you're living right, then when the end comes, you're prepared for it. If you're not living right, then any minute you're like, oh my God, I wish I had one more minute, because you could be dead in a second. And that would ruin it, but it also wouldn't ruin it because, well, if you had nothing to worry about, then if you were dead tomorrow, you'd be okay. And in that moment, her revelation is, at least this is the closest she's ever come to being a likable character, which is, wow, I'm not good. Everything is like, you know, settling in, everything is red, everything is sunset, and everything's like, take a breath and look at the big picture and see how small you are. I think that's very beautiful. It's very, very beautiful. Because then she sees in the end here that she lifts her head. There was only a purple streak in the sky cutting through a field of crimson and leading like an extension of the highway into the ascending dusk. She raised her hands from the side of the pen in a gesture hieratic and profound. A visionary light settled in her eyes. She saw the streak as a vast swinging bridge extending upward from the earth through a field of living fire. Upon it, a vast horde of souls were tumbling towards heaven. There were whole companies of white trash, clean for the first time in their lives, and bands of black folk in their white robes, and battalions of freaks and lunatics shouting and clapping like leaping frogs. And bringing at the end of the procession was a tribe of people whom she recognized as once those who, like herself and Claude, had always had a little of everything, and who'd given the wit to use it right. Like, she goes to bed every night counting her blessings or counting sheep at the expense of other people. Mm-hmm. And when she sees this vision rolled out, everyone in the story who she one by one by one has line itemed as worse than her. It's the last shall be first, right? And the first shall be last. The lunatics, the black folk, the poor white folk, the you know, everybody else. And she can't help but notice that even if they're going into heaven, she leans to observe them closer, they're marching behind the others with great dignity, accountable as they had always been for good order and common sense, respectable behavior. They alone were on key, yet she could see by their shocked and altered faces, even their virtues were being burned away. Like, what do you make of this? This very humbling moment is this vision kind of reaches its conclusion.
So, whenever I read this, and I think it's, I always liked the story as an introduction to O'Connor, because it's the Christian imagery, the biblical notes here are so obvious, and it seems, at least from my reading, that in most of our other stories, it's not as obvious as this. When you have this. Mm-hmm. This very souls going into heaven vision at the end.
It literally ends with the word hallelujah, right?
Exactly.
That's pretty overt. Yeah, that's fair, right?
Yep. But even the way that it's described, it's not this clean image of the saints marching into heaven, which is probably what she expected it to be, right? With her mm-hmm. and Claude at the front. But it's not them marching all in line, right? Freaks and lunatics shouting and clapping and leaping like frogs. Just this this disruption to whatever she thought the image was.
Go ahead. I was saying, even in her redemption, there's still like a disbelief. It's like, I was wrong. Oh my God, I'm still wrong. Even in saying how wrong I am, I'm wrong in my describing of how wrong I am. Like, there's layers to that.
Mm-hmm. And then this line, or these lines, they alone were on key. So the ones that were like herself and Claude, marching behind the others with great dignity, accountable, good order, common sense, respectable behavior, just like earlier in the story, right? Good disposition. Mm-hmm. But they alone were on key. And that's the singing, right? That they're singing in tune. And then she could see by their shocked and altered faces, even their virtues were being burned away. So this, even though there's like they seem to be perfect, there's like the shocked and altered faces. I don't know. That's one of the images from this story that I've just been thinking. I always think over like, what is that? What does that look like? Is this shock as in some sort of horror or fear, or I would think it would be more of a like awe or some sort of holy terror. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then the idea of virtues being burned, because this is something she's seeing. So like, what does that look like? Virtues being burned away.
Oh, that's a really great question. And the fact that like, it's the things they held dear, right? Where they stored up their treasures, that like, God doesn't care. He didn't care if you can sing or not sing. Like, he either loves you or doesn't love you, man. Like, there's nothing you can do to like, make a God who is all powerful more powerful, or all loving more loving. Like, I don't care about your virtues. I don't care about your height, your weight, your kindness, your, you know, what is it that I mean, there are things that you were born with. And that's the old saying, like, the things that we are born with are God's gifts to us. Our gifts to God is what we do with them. And like, all those virtues that we didn't use, like, okay, she had money, but was she kind? Did she ever spend time face to face with people, getting to know them as people? Or did she stratify? Did she rank? Did she, you know? And in that moment, it's like your virtue being burned away is, I don't know, you didn't get that from anybody but me in the first place there, boss. So I'm gonna go ahead and need that back, thanks. And what else you got? And you know, there's nothing you can do or not do in that moment to make God accept people who are in front of the line any less or more acceptable. I think it's a very humbling way to realize that your overall, you know, stature and things, it's cool. It's scary. I think I need an adult, or I need a hug. Let me ask this question about this story in general, right? Like, it is. So if you have to sell this to a student or an adult, if it's their first time in a Flannery O'Connor, you should read this story because ... Like, maybe we can use this as our closing activity for this one. I would say, like, if this one is one that I would say, read it, because more than any other Flannery O'Connor story, it's very overt with its symbolism. And if you get this, this is a nice, like, starter, like, take the training wheels off the bike and you can do another version of it, because it really does help you along the way. That's my read on it, but I'm interested to hear yours.
I would have said the same thing, since that was my, that was my reason for choosing this particular story to do, rather than A Good Man Is Hard to Find. I mean, that's not necessarily the one to start off with.
No, I feel like I could do a week's worth of podcast on that story. I mean, there's a lot to I might
do that. But also, also with this one, I think this does help unlock Flannery O'Connor's vision. So with this story, right, it ends with Mrs. Turpin looking. So she has this vision, the vision fades, and she's back to reality. But her reality has changed. The last line, "and woods around her, the invisible cricket choruses had struck up. But what she heard were the voices of the souls climbing upward into the starry field and shouting hallelujah." So now what she's experiencing around her, right, what she may have just taken for granted, the crickets, they're now imbued with this sense of the sacred. It's like this sacramental or even incarnational vision. And I think that that's in some ways a reflection of what Flannery O'Connor sets up in her stories. Not as overt, but that there is in her stories this this either be it Christ haunting or these mysteries and messages, these reflections of the divine in the most unlikely of places that she puts forward for us.
Victoria, this is awesome, man. I'm gonna go back and read it again now, because I have a lot of questions, maybe more questions than answers, but
that's always good, right? And as teachers, that's what we want. That's what we're not answer distributors. No, right?
I just want the right answer. Just give me the right answer. All right. Well, I think that'll be it for this week then. We want to thank you again for popping by the podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us and talking about Flannery O'Connor, for sure. Would you come back again, do it again?
Oh, 110%.
Perfect. Done. I'm going to hold you to it. We have a little bit of time between now and the start of the new school year, so we'll set something up. In the meantime, if you want to hang out with you on Twitter, Miss B DJO is you. I'm Meehan EDU on Twitter. And we'll call that a day. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to head over to the podcasting app of your choice. Leave a nice comment or a rating. It helps people find it and put this in the hands of other people who are interested. If you want to be a guest with a podcast of a story of your own, we can do this one again or any other ones, because I'm interested to keep talking. Please do. We want to say thanks again, and we'll be back next week with more. Thanks again.